Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
We return. We took a break. We took a week off.
1 week.
Because life, you know, life. And I got a beer.
Yep.
See if you can match it.
It's called The Truth, and it's a Imperial IPA.
And you know the brewery.
And the brewery is Flying Dog, which is a local brewery that we sort of imbibe in.
We do.
Relatively often here. But I would say maybe The Truth is your way of connecting to our first film, Dear Evan Hansen.
It is. It is a direct reference to Dear Evan Hansen, who has a problem with the truth in this film. And once again, I think we do this every single episode. I start with, no, Hannah, I haven't seen the Broadway musical. Because this is the umpteenth thousand Broadway musical adapted for the theater screen, like in the past calendar year.
Yeah.
Hamilton, uh-huh. In the Heights, uh-huh. Come From Away. Everyone's talking about Jamie, and released on top of that one. Like, on top of it. It hasn't even breathed, like, 7 days yet, is Dear Evan Hansen. And there's three more of these things to come.
Yay.
Before the end of this calendar year.
Including West Side Story, Steven Spielberg's version. So you know that's the big one that I think most people are really looking forward to.
So Dear Evan Hansen premiered on Broadway in 2016 with one Ben Platt. I believe he was 21 at the time, and it has since done 1,363 shows at the Music Box Theater. And I guess when something gets that popular, some executive in Hollywood's going to say, we got it. We got to get it. Go get me the rights. We got to do this. It's got 1,300 shows. It's a can't miss, I tell you.
I don't think that's how it works.
You don't think that's how it exactly went down? I think I'm pretty sure.
I don't know what agent you're talking to, but no, I think when it's popular and they realize that that people who don't have a chance to see the show on Broadway.
Really? That sounds like altruism. Let's do it for the poor
people
in Wyoming who couldn't make it to Manhattan.
But I mean, this won 6 Tony Awards, including Best Musical.
Did Cats win Tony Awards?
Oh, huge, huge.
Did it?
Yes, it won Tony Awards. And and as did West Side Story.
Well,
I'm
let's dive into this.
Mm-hmm.
What for the people who couldn't make it to Manhattan and are thinking or not thinking about making the trek to the theater to see Dear Evan Hansen? What's going on with Evan Hansen? Why is he in the title? What's he up to?
Well, and Evan Hansen is played by Ben Platt, who originated the role on Broadway. Today is, by the way, Ben Platt's 28th birthday.
Mm.
So this movie where he plays a socially anxious...
Hi, I'm a teenager.
Somewhat depressed.
Hi, guys.
Teenager in high school. You know, but then again, how old were... how old was Danny Zuko?
Put a pin in that.
Okay, we'll put a pin in that.
I want to get back to that later.
Anyway, so Evan Hansen, and this is different from, for instance, when we saw Hamilton or when we saw Come From Away, where that was literally you were taking the stage, you were doing a filmed version of a live stage show. This is not that. This is a dramatized film adaptation, but with the same general story where you have... I don't want to give too much away with the plot, but in essence, Evan Hansen is this isolated teenager who's in therapy, and part of his therapy is writing notes to himself. So, Dear Evan Hansen, sign me.
That's nice.
And what happens is that this sort of bully kid, who also has mental health problems of his own, swipes one of Evan's notes to himself.
Don't print that, by the way. Don't print your notes in the school library.
Yeah, always a bad move.
Like, what are you doing?
And then this other kid ends up committing suicide. Oh. And so the note is, everyone, the family believes that that this kid had some sort of friendship relationship going with Evan Hansen.
So our son commits suicide, and his suicide note is not to the family. It's not to mom. It's not to dad. It's not to the family dog. It's to Evan Hansen. Who the hell is Evan Hansen?
Yeah, and so that's really where this story takes off, and Evan Hansen, in the meantime, is all ready to sort of come clean and go, that wasn't a suicide note. That was my own note. But one misunderstanding leads to a big lie.
Should I call it a misunderstanding?
Leads to a perpetuation of lies.
It's a plot that could have been solved with one 90-second awkward conversation.
Yes, but then you wouldn't have these great best musical songs.
Are they?
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of exposition in this song.
There's a lot of... No, but that's... They are more ballads that are talking about...
These aren't West Side Story songs.
No, these are... These are anthems for isolation and acceptance and things like that. And so that's where that music really comes into play. This is not a jukebox musical. This is a drama that just sort of has some of these songs in it. And Ben Platt, as Evan Hansen for the casting, this is his role. This is his baby. And he is committed. And he's such a good singer. And he's the only one. When I hear these songs, it's you got to have Ben Platt singing them, because these are, you know, what you've come to know if you are at all familiar with Broadway, that these are Ben Platt songs for this musical. And so I did not see this show yet, and so I was really satisfied in terms of getting my curiosity resolved about what this show was and the story. It's not the typical kind of show that I go and see on Broadway, because I do prefer the bigger spectacle kind of musicals. But my niece had seen this on Broadway. She loved it. It's got a huge fan base, and so I think the fan base will be somewhat divided as to how it plays out on the big screen. But I, for one, think that some of the critics have been overly harsh, and I think that you're going to have a fair number of people who actually really enjoy this film. It's it's really all about ultimately kind of acceptance and coming of age stuff. And so I do think that there's an audience for it, and I do think some people have been overly harsh.
Ben Platt has the voice of an angel. The guy, I don't care how old he is, that guy can sing.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is the songs stink. The songs aren't good.
No.
3 days later, I'm not humming it, I'm not singing it, I'm not going to Spotify to play it. They're not memorable. He's singing the plot. Like, all right, I'm opening the door.
You are not alone.
And I'm opening the window.
You Are Not Alone is an anthem that everyone who's seen the show.
So I had not seen the show. I'm like you. Hadn't seen the show, didn't know the plot, didn't know nothing, didn't know who Ben Platt was.
But when you hear that song, You Are Not Alone.
I didn't like the songs. No, I just didn't hit. But the guy, I loved his voice.
Yeah.
Good Lord, he's so good. It's taking so much heat that, of course, how can you cast him? I can see his withered face and his prunes, and he's so old and his baggy eyes. He's not 17. Okay, no, he's not 17, but I want the best singer in the role.
Mm-hmm.
He's the best singer.
Mm-hmm.
Directed by Stephen Chbosky. Stephen Chbosky is responsible for probably the best, or close to the best, teenage alienation film, angst, suicidal problem, suicidal tendencies film of the past decade, in 2012's The Perks of Being a
mm-hmm.
Wallflower. Phenomenal film.
Yep.
Loved everything about it. He also did 2017's Wonder, which is still on the bestseller
Excellent.
List. Still on the bestseller
Excellent
list.
Excellent film.
So this is a great choice for a director. And it's the same writer. The guy who wrote the book for Broadway, Stephen Levinson. He said, you know what? I want to update it. And he did. And he changed the ending.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to tell you what. I'm not going to tell you why. I'm not going to tell you how. But if anyone's going to get upset over, well, I don't know why you get upset over a guy's age, or you're upset maybe you just didn't, maybe they dropped your favorite song, because they did drop a few songs,
mm-hmm.
and they built up Amanda Stenberg's character, who was actually quite minor in the musical version. Now she's somewhat of a major character. They changed the ending. I'm surprised. There must be a Dear Evan Hansen army with their own hashtags, who would be setting fire to things right now because it changed the ending. And I'm shocked that I don't see that online right now.
I don't think we're going to see it as vehemently as you seem to think, and that some people are anticipating.
This is a known quantity.
But I think that it's not changed all that. I just don't think that's going to be the thing that will make or break this film for the Evan Hansen fans. Because it's slightly different, but it's more like just sort of this extra bit of an ending, an extra tidbit tacked on. And if anything, the Broadway fans who just do know the playlist so well and who do know the soundtrack and will be missing certain songs, that's going to stick with them, I suspect, a little bit more. But ultimately, the thing that was strangest for me, it took me a few minutes to get a little past Ben Platt's age. Like, I acknowledge that when he first comes on screen, you know, and there's that, like, the high school locker, you feel a little bit like how old he's supposed to be. And then I think back to, like, 21 Jump Street and all
that
kind of stuff.
Let's do this. I have a quiz. Uh-oh. A quiz for Hannah. This could be out of one of your teen magazines that I'm sure you still read. I'm going to give you three actors and their corresponding characters, and they each have some sort of an age difference. I want you to give me who you think has the biggest, who's got the biggest age difference.
Okay.
All right. So right now, our bottom line, our foundation is Ben Platt. He's 27. He's playing 17. 10-year mm-hmm. difference. So, all right. First one. Is it John Travolta uh-huh. as Danny Zuko?
Yeah.
Is it Alan Ruck as Cameron in Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
Oh, my goodness.
Or is it Jennifer Grey as Baby? Who's the biggest difference?
Wow. I mean, if I had to think, because now I'm thinking Jennifer Grey might actually be like 50 years old now or in her 50s, late 40s for sure. I don't know. The first thing that always comes to mind is John Travolta and how old he and Olivia Newton-John probably were. And also I remember Stocker Channing playing the character she did.
Rizzo.
Rizzo in Grease. I think she was in her mid to late 20s at the time, too. I'm not really sure because I can't remember how old the guy from Ferris Bueller's Day Off would have been because he was the friend, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just to get this quiz over with, I'm going to say John Travolta.
Well, if I had put Stocker Channing on there, she would have won so far. They were all playing 18. She was 33.
Okay, that's...
And Olivia Newton-John, by the way, was 29.
Yeah, no, that's just it.
Danny Zuko, John Travolta, was actually the closest in age.
Okay.
He was playing 18. He was only 23. Just a five-year difference. Jennifer Grey, as Baby, she was playing 17. She was 27.
Okay.
So just like Ben Platt.
Yeah.
But the big winner, Alan Ruck, as Cameron, who was playing 17, was 29.
Yeah, and I really wouldn't 29. Have even... And how much do we hear about Alan Ruck these
He's
days?
He's still around. You see Alan Ruck.
But I love Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It's a great, great movie, too. So all three of those are actually excellent movies. So I would just say that that is not a deal breaker for Evan Hansen. And what makes Evan Hansen... I think what elevates it is the supporting cast. And it has a really, really good supporting cast. So whereas Ben Platt, to me, the hardest thing is just in the scenes where he just has to do straight acting. He still feels very much like a stage actor to me. He does, he's committed to this character without a doubt. But when you're acting up against Julianne Moore as his mother and Amy Adams as the mother of the other kid, and even Catherine Deaver, who plays, who's the sister of the guy who kills himself and becomes a love interest for Evan Hansen, she is amazing in Booksmart. I really like her. And so I think she did really well. I think the supporting cast really helps put this movie slightly above where it might otherwise have been, given all the criticism. You've got a really good cast.
Not the biggest. I don't hate it. A lot of people hate this. A lot of vitriol. I don't hate it. I damn sure don't love it. I'd say go watch everybody talk about Jamie instead.
No, absolutely. I was going to say, if you are a theater geek, I think this is worth putting into the mix. But I do think that everybody's talking about Jamie, Come From Away. You know, those are still out there and a slightly
And both
better.
Superior. Absolutely. Especially Come From Away. Moving on. Let's talk about Germany's entry for the Best International Film Oscar for next year.
I hope
for
so.
For next year, for 2022. They've already picked it. They say this is our entry. They picked it. This is it.
Wow.
And they call it Ich bin dein Mensch. You know it as I'm your man. I'm your man. In fact, Dan Stevens is your... I sent this to you because I knew your boy. Your
Did
boy,
I love me
Dan Stevens. We last saw him. We most recently saw him in Eurovision, The Story of Fire Saga. I saw him in the X-Men television spinoff Legion. So good. We saw him as Charles Dickens in The Man Who Invented Christmas. And, of course, he was the Beast.
And I believe he's also started in Downton Abbey on the TV show.
Wouldn't know.
But
but he's Tom.
Tom.
He's Tom. Hannah, who is Tom?
This was a fun little interesting foreign film. To me, the fact that you have a foreign film with Dan Stevens, who knew that Dan Stevens could speak German?
Flawless.
I did not.
Flawless German.
But he doesn't have to speak anything all that flawlessly because he's playing a robot.
Oh, my goodness.
But he's those eyes. Oh, my gosh. If you were going to have
a
humanoid,
like mountain lakes,
you want Dan Stevens' eyes. Tom. Is a robot, but this really isn't about Tom. Mm. It's about this researcher named Alma who needs more funds for her research. She's working on some weird thing that I didn't understand what
cuneiform.
It was
cuneiform. She's an expert in cuneiform.
What is cuneiform?
That's what they used to write back in the day, like before hieroglyphics.
Okay, so she's this accomplished researcher in Berlin, and she is persuaded to take part in this study. Mostly because she's single. That's basically the qualification that was necessary for her to take part in this.
Spinster, you say.
And then she's supposed to provide an evaluation at the end. Mm. But so for 3 weeks, she has to live with this humanoid robot named Tom, who has been programmed to fit her ideal mate, to become her ideal.
So this was built
perfect
for
mate.
Her.
She
filled out a quiz like you, bubbled in the bubble sheet.
And she's got her own quirks and, personality. And she could be, I would say, probably high maintenance in some relationships or a little tough. So Tom, though, is really programmed to be perfect for
He's
her.
Good.
But she's very skeptical.
She's crusty.
She's crusty and unsentimental. And so she doesn't really know what this whole experiment, where it's really going to lead. But she wants her funding. So she's like, fine, I'll live with Tom for a little while. And so, of course, Tom's algorithm shifts. He learns as he interacts with her to always sort of be improving upon what will be acceptable to her. And Tom is still darn good looking. So, you got the whole...
He's okay.
You got the fact that Tom is a hot humanoid, okay? And so
the old double
H. He also really is. He's romantic. And she is conflicted because she's starting to warm to this humanoid, to this robot. Even though she kind of knows, in her mind that's really he is not real. So it brought back a little shades to me of Lars and the Real Girl, a little bit of Her. Mm. So to me, this is just it's a different spin on that notion of AI and romance. So, I don't know. What did you think of?
Well, this is built. This is marketed, or at least very well could be marketed, as a rom-com. It's got the whole setup. Can the perfect man, specifically designed for her, melt the closed-off, emotionally void scientist's heart? But it's not a rom-com.
No.
It's not.
It's a drama.
It's a philosophical, sociological, ethical exploration. Mm-hmm. There are, you chuckle every now and then, but that is few and far between. Directed by Maria Schrader. We know her. She did 2020's Unorthodox, mm-hmm. that four-episode thing with a little Esty running away to Germany on Netflix. She won an Emmy for Outstanding Directing for a Limited Series, Movie, or Dramatic Special, which I think the Queen's Gambit just won the other night. Maren Eggert. She plays Dr. Alma Felza. Mm-hmm. Maren Eggert. She won. She won the award at the Berlin International Film Festival for Best Acting Performance.
Ah, good no, on her. I can see that. I mean, this is her film.
She's good. She's got some heavy lifting to do.
Mm-hmm.
She's the straight man. He's trying to be the goofball. I saw her in 2017's The Invisibles, Die Unsichtbaren. She was quite good.
Mm-hmm.
And the film was nominated for the Golden Bear, and it was just at Toronto. Last week, it's our second film from Toronto, I believe. We're going to talk about Tammy Faye next, which was also at Toronto. This is a prequel to Spielberg's AI. Like, this is first-generation humanoid.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a few generations before her, with Joaquin Phoenix and Scarlett Johansson as his consort operating system. This really reminded me of 1987's Making Mr. Right, if you remember that, with John Malkovich.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar film. Much better film, though, than that movie. I enjoyed this film. I enjoyed it a lot. It's as deep as you want it to be. And
yes.
I made it pretty deep,
Hannah. Yeah, sure.
People going into this wanting a meet cute and to laugh, like, oh, will the robot, will she fall in love with the robot? You're going to be disappointed. This movie ain't for you.
No, that's not what it is at all. And so it is very much a robotic romantic drama. It's hard to really classify, but I think that's what makes it interesting. The good thing about, and I'm telling you, for me, it's having Dan Stevens in that lead role is going to give it, I think, a few more eyeballs domestically than it might otherwise have gotten. Because it is. It's a German film. It's in German. And I was okay with that throughout. But the good thing, too, is that while this is actually in theaters now, it will be released digitally in just a couple of weeks on October 12th. So even if you don't want to go out to an art house theater to see this film, just wait around. I think it's fine to then try and rent from home in a few weeks.
All right, let's catch up with something we missed last week because we didn't record. And what opened last week, and which nobody saw, according to the box office numbers, shame on all of you, is The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Now, if you are, I'm going to say 50. If you're 50 or older, Tammy Faye's in your wheelhouse. If you're 49 or younger,
you might have missed it.
You know, like, if you're 40 and older, you know who she is. But if you're like me and you're like 41, you weren't really there. Like, you were there and you heard the name on the news, maybe, or someone making fun of her, but you didn't really know why. So even I am a little bit too young for this biographical drama. I know Tammy Faye is someone, at least back then, you were allowed to make fun of her. In the late 80s, you could make fun of Tammy Faye for her mannerisms, how she looked. She was like 10 years prior to Linda Tripp,
mm-hmm.
who in the late 90s, you were allowed to make fun of for how she looked. Things have changed.
Yeah.
But she was game on. So they have now, Jessica Chastain, who owns the rights to Tammy Faye's entire life, by the way, produced The Eyes of Tammy Faye. So Hannah, is Tammy Faye, was she in your wheelhouse? Did you come in with Tammy Faye knowledge? And B, is this biographical drama working for you?
Well, it's Jessica Chastain not only bought the rights, but she takes on the lead role in this biopic. So she plays Tammy Faye Baker. And she watched the documentary that this film was adapted based on. And she immediately turned around and was like, I want the rights and I want to do this story. So good on her for actually saying, this is a character I can really get into that I feel some empathy towards. And she made it happen. But so while I have a recollection of the scandal in the 1980s that unfolded with Jim Baker and Tammy Faye and how they basically, I remembered that there was a bit of a sex scandal, there was a drug scandal, there was a financial scandal. Tammy Faye was sort of standing by her man. I remember Jim Baker like crying on the air. And I remember feeling like no sympathy. They truly were kind of like these buffoonish characters that had made millions and millions of dollars off of the PTL followers. They were, you know, the televangelists of the day. And since I really did not watch any of this stuff, certainly not as a kid, I only knew the scandal and the stories that evolved and the skit, the SNL skits that followed, and the caricatures of Tammy Faye's mascara dripping all over the place while she's crying. And so, yes, it was, I probably had a stronger connection, recollection to the actual scandal than you did, but I was not really at all familiar with any of the backstory and the and just what laid behind the relationship between Tammy Faye and Jimmy Baker.
Whatever it is that Jim Baker, played by Andrew Garfield, later on with big, like, fat, fake, prosthetic chipmunk cheeks, whatever it is he did, it's all off screen. They actually don't tell you too much about what he did in the movie. Like, there's a sentence here or there about financial improprieties and maybe sexual improprieties. I had to go on Wikipedia. Wikipedia Jim Baker. I'm like, what did he do? The movie, I know it's the eyes of Tammy Faye, so through her eyes, but apparently she didn't know because they don't talk about it. That's actually got on my nerves a little bit. Like, you have to tell me what he did. Directed by Michael Showalter. Very curious choice. This man got his start in the mid-90s on MTV's The State, if you remember that. I certainly do. The co-creator of the Wet Hot American Summer franchise, 2015's Hello, My Name is Doris with Sally Field.
Yeah. Wow.
2017's The Big Sick with Kumail Nanjiani and Zoe Kazan. And 2020's The Lovebirds, again with Nanjiani and Issa Rae.
Yeah.
He directs comedies, and usually very good comedies, especially with The Big Sick. So why they said, hey, Showalter, come over here and take on this non-comedy. Like, we're not here to laugh along with Tammy Faye or laugh at Tammy Faye. It's not heavy lifting either. This is middle of the road.
Yeah, this is a as biopics go, this is mediocre at best. However, Jessica Chastain does a phenomenal job sort of stepping into Tammy Faye's shoes and eyelashes. The transformation, Oscar voters love a biopic transformation, when especially if they sing, even better. And Jessica Chastain does do her own singing, belting out some of Tammy Faye's signature gospel songs, which I don't think I really, really knew her singing side.
You're on the brink.
But I loved it.
America.
I know, but it was so...
That has more memorable songs than Dear Evan Hansen.
It did. It was pretty funny. I was enjoying the music. But I would not be surprised in the least to see Jessica Chastain in the mix, at least nominated for Best Actress.
We'll see. It's early.
It's early, but I'm putting it out there.
People are going to forget. And I don't think people didn't like this movie. People didn't like this movie.
But here's my thing. Judy, did you like Judy?
No.
Renee Zellweger won Best Actress for playing Judy Garland.
But that was released
in a mediocre...
When it was supposed to be.
Doesn't matter. It was a mediocre film, a mediocre biopic, and yet Renee Zellweger won. Meryl Streep playing Margaret Thatcher in The Iron Lady.
I like that more than everybody else did.
That
I actually
movie
like
was
that movie.
Boring
no,
as all
it
get
it's
out.
A great movie.
But Meryl Streep was great in it.
Yeah, she was. She's outstanding. She deserved it. Earned
and
it.
She won.
Loved everything about it.
But so that's why I am pretty sure that we can put the bet out now.
Maybe.
Our bottle of wine. Our wine wager for Oscar season.
It wouldn't blow my mind. Like, oh my God, how could you not? No, she's great. Jessica Chastain is great.
Yeah.
But how much will this... not a barely mediocre film, bring her down and lose her votes because no one wants to go back and watch this a second time.
Yeah, that's
nobody.
Very true. I absolutely agree with that.
This has a 66% tomato meter, which is quite low for an art house film with award aspirations. Art house films that won awards, they're coming in at 90. They're not coming in at 66.
Yeah. No, I don't think this is worthy of anything other than a potential actress nomination for Jessica Chastain. It did, however, give you a different perspective. Like, I did walk away, and I think this was the intent of the film, was to paint a different picture of Tammy Faye that actually makes her really appear very sincere. And the sincerity of her mission and of her love for people.
And money.
Well, the money part, she definitely had that material.
She loved herself some money.
But I think she really did also just love doing what she did in engaging with people.
Well, yeah, it showed her embracing the LGBTQ community and the AIDS crisis. When people like Jerry Falwell are like, how dare you, madam? How
exactly.
dare you?
Yeah.
I shunned you. Get out of under my roof.
Yeah, so when you saw these sort of secondary characters with Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and you know that there was like that whole set of televangelists and Jimmy Swaggart. So the fact that she was able to sort of stand up for herself and what she believed in doing, you know, good on her. But yeah, this is just such a mediocre movie. It's a shame because Jessica Chastain is very good.
I almost want to go back and watch the 2000 documentary. A,
yes,
to learn something.
Too.
But B, because it's narrated by RuPaul.
RuPaul, exactly. And apparently it's a very good documentary. And I can see how the documentary probably is fascinating. So, yes, that's good homework, is to maybe see the documentary instead.
All right. You went ahead and watched one of this week's Netflix offerings. There's one called The Starling, starring Melissa McCarthy, that we did not watch, nor do I have any plans to. But you watched The Guilty. And I didn't watch it because I already seen it. In fact, I saw it like 2 to 3 years ago, and it was in Danish. And when that happens, when Americans say, oh, that was such a good foreign film, it was so good, got to make it American. Get me Jake Gyllenhaal on the phone. Got to make it over here. I say, no, sir. That's, no, sir, I will not.
But that's not what happened. Jake Gyllenhaal saw it at Sundance. It won.
And he's
Sundance.
Like, hey, I don't have any original ideas. Let me play something someone's already played.
No, in 2018, and he went, this is just an awesome movie, and people aren't going to go see this Danish movie as much as they should.
We saw it.
So we saw it, but and loved it. I mean, it's the original.
It's outstanding.
Den Skildige, I believe it's called.
Oh, that one, yeah.
But it's also known as The Guilty, but it was a Danish movie with a really good performance by the lead actor in that. But so this is... still worth seeing because it's just a good different American version.
I hate when they remake stuff. I can't believe that.
I know you hate the remakes, but to me it was no different. Yeah, I mean you hated it when they remade that. They remade that one with Liam Neeson.
They did.
That was like word for word identical.
Disgusting. Disgusting.
But I would say if you did not see the Danish version of The Guilty, then this is a really good Netflix choice because, so Jake, it was actually all filmed in less than 2 weeks at the height of COVID. And the reason they were able to do that is because it all takes place essentially in one room in a 911 call center. And Jake Gyllenhaal's character is really just essentially on the headset, on the phone, the entire movie. It's very tense. It's dramatic. I think Jake Gyllenhaal really wanted to just play a version of this guy because he can capture that intensity and the roller coaster of emotions. He has that capability, so you needed a good actor. So it's very similar. It is very similar to the Danish version that we saw and loved. But Jake plays Joe Baylor, and he is he's a police officer, a police detective who's been demoted and is sent to go work at this 911 call center as a dispatch while he's awaiting trial or there's an investigation of some sort going on. And so he's just kind of waiting to see how that all plays out. And so he takes this call, and he's not happy at all to be there. And most of the calls that he's getting, he's just like, whatever, there's a guy who gets rolled by a prostitute and calls 911 expecting the cops to come and arrest this woman. He has obviously no sympathy for that. And he's very frustrated with a lot of the calls that he's getting. But then the hook is that he gets this call from this woman who appears to have been kidnapped by her ex. And the whole film is about him trying to find her in this car on the LA freeways. And it takes some really fascinating twists and turns. It's just an intense ride, and I can't tell you any more about the plot because it's very close. The whole thing, it's very absorbing, and you're only in this one location, and you only see Jake Gyllenhaal's character for the most part and him on the phone. Everything else is just you're hearing the audio from the other people that he's interacting with. whether it be another LAPD partner of his or someone from the CHP, from a CHIPS person, another dispatcher. And I didn't know until after I'd watched this whole film and I went back and realized that they got some kick-ass supporting voices. Ethan Hawke is in this, theoretically. Peter Sarsgaard and Paul Dano, Riley Q. I never know how her
Riley last name. Riley
Keough. Keough.
Elvis's granddaughter.
Elvis's granddaughter, Riley, is basically the voice of the woman who's been abducted. And so they were all able to sort of really talk about phoning it in for your roles and with the COVID protocols. This is Jake Gyllenhaal's movie. This is an hour and a half, very intensely watching Jake Gyllenhaal go through this tremendous range of emotions, trying to save this woman and to figure out where she is, what exactly happened. And there is some just really, really gripping, intense stuff. And so it's just really good for the same reasons that we liked that original Danish one. This is just a good choice if you've got Netflix and you're just looking for just something intense and pretty and really well-paced to just get absorbed in.
This is not Jake Gyllenhaal's movie.
You know, it's a slow burn. You generally like those slow burns.
I can't even fathom watching this knowing the twist. This is kind of a big, like, I couldn't watch it because I know what happens. Do not look this up, by the way.
Exactly. It does cloud your, it does have.
You watched it differently.
I watched it differently.
Because you knew it was coming.
I absolutely watched it differently, remembering that, vaguely remembering the twist. And so, yes, it is, a little something is lost, but that's why I definitely think if you haven't seen the Danish version and you have no intention of seeing the Danish version, then I think The Guilty is worth checking out.
Humbug, Cratchit. Humbug. All right. I watched a Netflix film, and I watched it with my kid because it's the, well, it was movie night, but it's the kid's offering last week on Netflix called Night Books. And I call it an introduction to the horror genre. It's based on a 2018 horror fantasy children's book of the same name by J.A. White. It's a dark fantasy directed by David Yuravsky. I saw his initial outing in 2019 called Brightburn. I don't think you saw that. That was a kid with superpowers who does not become a superhero because he uses them for other means. Oof.
I think I did see that.
I wasn't the biggest fan of that. It's produced by Sam Raimi, by the way. Evil Dead series, first Spider-Man trilogy, that guy.
Wow.
Adapted by Mickey Daughtry and Tobias Iaconis. And the reason I bring that up is because I saw them. They adapted 2019's The Curse of La Llorona, which is in the Conjuring series. You saw them.
Mm-hmm.
You saw them in one I didn't see called 5 Feet Apart.
Ah, yes.
I did not see that. So what we got here is little Winslow Fegley. He's playing Alex Mosher. You know, that name should be like, what do you mean Winslow Fegley? Where have I heard Fegley? He's the younger brother of Oaks Fegley, 2016's Pete's Dragon, remake. The Goldfinch, he was the boy in the Goldfinch. Mm-hmm. Alex Mosher loves horror films. He's probably 9 or 10 years old, and he's a weird guy in his school because he's young Tim Burton. And you imagine how popular that must make him. And you don't know why, but at the beginning of the film, he's very, very, very upset. And he kind of runs away from his New York apartment building. And he stumbles into this open apartment, which is it's like inviting him in. Come on in, little boy. It's got a little piece of pumpkin pie. It's got an empty chair. Like, hey, come on in. Eats the pie. Kidnapped by a witch. Kidnapped by a witch. The witch, by the way, played by Kristen Ritter. Ritter. You know her as Jessica Jones. She was in Breaking Bad. She's the witch. She says, I'm going to kill you, Alex. I'm going to kill you unless you tell me a scary story every night. And she's got her reasons why that is. And mm-hmm. So he's now locked in this witch's apartment. There's a mystery. Who is she? Where's she coming from? What am I going to do? I got to come up with scary stories. He's okay with that. He can come up with scary stories. And it branches off from there. 80% on the tomato meter. I'm with them. Big thumbs up. I got a kick out of this movie. Love me some Night Books. I made double sure that, hey man, my kid, you're not too scared to go to bed tonight, are you? He's like, no, he's okay.
It's PG. I
looked
it up.
But it's intense. Like, It's PG, but for like 11-year-olds. Like, don't show this to your 5-year-old.
Well, and I think that's important to note because I did. I looked it up and you said you had seen it with your kid. I'm like, okay, it's PG. So maybe this is sort of your family-friendly...
Things happen to kids in this movie.
Yeah.
Like Grimm's brother, like the real Grimm's brother kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, you know how that is unsettling? That kind of stuff happens to kids in this movie, which is why, like, oh, okay, it's not the worst thing you've ever seen. It's just, it's honest to God, if it's the great introduction to horror. Like, I can't show him James Cameron's Aliens, even though I really want to. I want to introduce him to Ripley. He's not ready. I can't show him Friday the 13th, can't show him Halloween, can't show him any of that stuff. But Night Books is such a good step one, horror 101. Let's do this. He got a kick out of it. I got a kick out of it. This is great stuff.
Good. Good. Good family choice.
Let's go over to TV. Opening this, starting this week on Apple TV Plus, is probably one of the best known sci-fi stories ever written because it's Isaac Asimov. The Foundation series, the sci-fi drama. This is intrepid business. Like, no one's really tried this before because how do you... It's like Dune. It's like making Dune. How do you make Foundation? Well, somebody's damn sure gonna try. In fact, it's Jared Harris. He's Harry Seldon. Lee Pace is the Emperor, Emperor Cleon. And I've learned... I didn't read Foundation.
Me either.
In high school, I saw some of my bros reading Foundation. I wasn't at that point. And I learned all about psychohistory, which is predicting the future through math. They're predicting that the empire, the big empire rule in the galaxy, is going to fall. Civil war, it's going to break apart and going to plunge in the dark ages. The mathematician behind that, Harry Seldon, says, hey, you guys are in trouble, listen to me. And they're like, heretic, heretic, we're not going to fall, we're all powerful. I exile thee, I exile thee. And he takes his followers. So the first two episodes are already available, right now, already available, and then they're going to do for the next 8 weeks, one per week, and I'm going to join them on that quest. I'm going to finish this. I love the look of this. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. I can't tell you if it's overstuffed. Is the books overstuffed? I don't know. Maybe they are. I know they changed, it was a boys club. I guess every character in Foundation was a male. It was written in the 40s. Well, they changed, I guess it's a big character in the book, and she's a big character so far, Gail Dornick. Is a boy in the film. She's a girl now. So, you know, they're updating it to 2021 sensibilities, all inclusive. I don't know how that's going to piss anybody off who's like this Asimov fan club, maybe like Dear Evan Hansen, you know, hashtag Asimov. But call me a fan. I'm in for Foundation through the long haul. This has the feeling of an epic story. This is like Dune. We're covering 1,000 years, I think, in this story.
And that's why I just didn't start it, because I don't feel like getting involved in a 1,000-year-long epic story that's going to unfold over the next 2 months. I did not read the book, so I have no foundation for the series at all.
Nice.
So if you're an Isaac Asimov sci-fi series drama fan, I'm sure... that I see Foundation mentioned in the Twitterverse every day, and so people are looking for it, but I don't think it's just not my genre.
What is your genre?
My people.
Who are your people?
My people are watching Ted Lasso.
There is
a reason that Ted Lasso just won a bunch of Emmys. It's because the series is just so good. Although it was very odd, the week that we took off, and first of all, I do want to mention, we do have to do a shout out to one of our listeners who hopefully is still listening, even though we totally screwed up our Ted Lasso bit last time. She pointed out, I think her name is Caroline, or Carolyn, apologies. She was like, I think you're wrong about how many episodes Ted Lasso is this season. Because we thought it had wrapped with 8, because we only got early access to 8. And so I hadn't seen any additional ones put into the mix. So I thought we were just sort of ending on another sort of mini cliffhanger with 8. But she pointed out that there are 12 in season 2. And sure enough, right after she pointed that out, I went to our little preview screening area and saw that, sure enough, in episode 9 of Ted Lasso had been posted. It was called Beard After Hours. It was an odd episode. It was one of those standalone noir kind of.
Maybe that's why I liked it.
I think that's why you liked it. So some people might have been sort of turned off a little bit by that particular episode, although we had mentioned that we were expecting Where's Our Coach Beard-centric episode, and sure enough, that was it that week. So some people are, if you're at episode 9, just know that episode 10, which is now available on Apple TV Plus, takes you back to our favorite world of Ted Lasso, and it is called No Weddings and a Funeral. And you know that I can't resist all these Ted Lasso episodes that find some way to sort of reference romantic comedies and romantic dramas. And sure enough, episode 10 does that. It gets a few of those main narratives back on track. It gives you just enough different pathways with relationships. It's just a very well-written episode. You find these chuckles in the midst of a funeral. And it's not all Roy Kent.
No, it's actually a Rebecca episode.
It is a Rebecca.
Who just won the Emmy for Supporting Actress. Seth Rogen announced it as Hannah Waddington, even though her name is Hannah Waddingham. She beat her co-star Juno Temple for that. It's a Rebecca episode. And you like
it
for whatever. And Rick Astley's in it. You like this episode a lot better than I did. Man, season one was just so much better than season two.
I don't know, but this episode, this particular episode, No Weddings and a Funeral, kind of brought me back in. Like, there were a few in the middle of this season two that that I wasn't loving, but this one brought me back.
How can you call the show Ted Lasso? He's not even in it anymore.
So, Ted, so maybe there will eventually be a couple of spinoffs in the additional seasons. But yeah, this one really is focused on Rebecca. And her father's funeral is essentially what happened. Like we got to know him so well in previous episodes. But it just, and there is a lot of Rick Astley. You will leave watching this episode never with a total earworm. You will be singing.
Better than Dear Evan Hansen. Never gonna let
that's
you
true.
Down.
You will be singing Never Gonna Give You Up for like forever. This was just some of the best stuff came from when there was no dialogue, where there was just a reaction shot throughout.
Never gonna say goodbye.
Oh, see, that's what happens. So obviously, this episode did stick with you.
No, it's because it's the most addictive earworm song in the history of pop music. It's Rick Astley.
But so shout out to Caroline. We do have two
more. Props, Caroline. Thank you.
We do have two more episodes.
Listener of the week, right there. Listener of the week.
That's right. So Brett, Christian, all you guys, you're out of the running now.
Well, you're always in the running, but not last one. Sorry, Caroline's got you.
Yeah. So there are. In fact, two more episodes to go of this season. And so we'll see if they can sustain what I felt was sort of a return to form with this week's episode.
I don't know how you're going to find it until it comes on demand, but this week's best movie is Ich bin dein Mensch. I'm your man. So good luck finding that.
Yeah, it actually, I'd say it's on par. I would also say The Guilty is the one that you can just go and watch right away.
Saying it. Don't know.
Or you can do Charlie a favor and go fish out that Danish version of The Guilty, and it that one is really, really, really good as well.
Hey, I made this copy of the Salvatore Mundi. You want it? It's just as good as the original. Here's a copy, though. It's just as good, though.
There were two,
two
Salvatore Mundi documentaries in one month.
I made this copy.
If there can be two Salvatore Mundi documentaries in one month, then there can be two Guilties in 5 years.
Gonna disagree on that. All right. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.